All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to We're Live, John Bowd's All the Rage, and we're on time. I can't believe it. And I'm off this week, and we're on time. Unbelievable. So far, we're going to talk about, I'm not sure, because if it's post 9/11 culture, good. If it's pre 9/11 culture, then we're going to have to drift into the 90s, John, and I like a little bit of Backstreet Boys and S Club 7 and all that. But anyway, John?
Yes, drift. Never mind drifting, actively escaping from the 90s is the hard thing. I tell you what tonight's basically about, the show this week, is I've been listening to quite a few podcasts and other types of media here and there who have been pontificating upon the anniversary of 9/11, but rather than mourn meaninglessly or whinge about it, these clever folks have been discussing the culture of that time and in some cases reflecting on how it got us to the place where we are now. So while I'm not going to aim to repeat any of those podcasts and other media, and I highly recommend you check them out yourself, specifically the recent two-part Chapo Trap House on the 9/11 culture and lots of work from Navarro Media, but I would like to pick up the mantle here and take it in another direction to cover a few things either related or perhaps, I suppose, a sort of offshoot on the subject. And bear in mind, this is my loose interpretation of offshoot. And in some cases, it bears little obvious connection, but that's basically just how my brain works. I was listening to these things, I was reading about these things, and my mind sort of pontificated and wondered about this, that, and the other. That's kind of how it works, actually, and that's where we've got a good portion of our shows from over the last few years. Anyway, the main thing I was reminded of listening to all of this reminiscence, firstly, is what real cancel culture actually looks like. Not the rabble of right-wing leftovers we have today, who everyone knows are not worth paying attention to, who now make a living making themselves victims. This is a time we're going to be talking about where people got seriously cancelled, actually meant something. Harping back is not my favourite pastime, to say the least, but if you can actually learn something from the past, it has worth to look back to it, I always say. Certainly if you're honest about the past, and that's something we've always tried to be on this show, not least about how absolutely terrible the 90s was, among other things. Looking back to the world as most of us knew it in the early 2000s, it looks pretty empty and grim, just like it did at the time. As regular listeners know, as I've already mentioned two or three times this evening, I hate both the 80s and the 90s. And one of the many reasons why is the deathly effect these two decades had on the culture that followed in the following years, in the following decade, in fact. Everything was the same and a weak repeat at best. This had the obvious effect on politics too. It was basically, if I were going to sum it up, it's best summed up by Mark Fisher, who gets his first mention of the week in Capitalist Realism. Basically, there's so much you can do, but there comes a point when you're not allowed to change anything. It was already getting quite rough in those days. The post-Cold War inertia meant that new enemies needed to be found, and most of them these days were actually at home. Suddenly, when hostilities began in the Balkans again, it was necessary for Britain and the US to intervene this time, and they were able to portray a simple in-out liberal intervention as a success, which was, of course, a fair bit messier than that. The people in power did not, and still do not, like a world where we are not constantly in fear, so the end of hostilities with the Soviet Union was bad business, not least for the weapons industry. 9/11 gave them the tragedy they could turn to their own advantage again. It was, to a degree, what they were looking for. That doesn't mean I'm saying they planned it. Don't start any of that crap. Right? After this horrible and horrific event, the US government under George W. Bush launched two wars fairly quickly. It is without doubt that at least one of these, Iraq, would have been launched no matter what, and probably advanced too if it had been successful, which it most certainly wasn't. Afghanistan was just as much of a blunder from the off as Iraq was. Many knew this, but they were not given the same airtime and space as the apologists and supporters of the wars did to themselves. Again, thanks to a weak media and public culture, this was very easily achieved. It is just as quick a time. In just as quick a time, resistance disappeared to these wars. It didn't, but as far as your media was concerned, as far as where you could see it publicly, it basically disappeared. We were now in a new era of rampant capitalism, endless wars, and zero chance of change. The harshest attacks and censorship were in the US at this time, but there are many examples here too. I will discuss that as we go on. So what I want to do to begin with is discuss three specific examples, and I'll briefly discuss another one which I thought of today when I was coming home. Just three examples of extreme censorship, extreme cancel culture, real cancel culture, as took place in America around about this time. So the journalist Chris Hedges had by this point been the foreign correspondent of the New York Times for 15 years. His reporting on the Middle East and the Balkans conflict often won him and the paper awards. But when he made a speech on the campus of Rockfield College in Illinois against the war in Iraq, the paper issued a strong criticism for his comments. This is the actual editorial, writing against their own employee, their own foreign correspondent. He had even previously published an article making the unsubstantiated claim that Iraq was involved in training terrorists, such as many of those who carried out the 9/11 attacks, and that had actually been printed in the New York Times, despite being totally crap and having no basis of reality. But anyway, as soon as he deviated from the paper's line on the war, they were onto him. He left the paper not long after it, but it's hard to see that this was not him being pushed, really. He may have, technically speaking, resigned, but, you know, how much work do you think he's going to get done at that paper when the editorial are actually writing against him? Next up, the filmmaker and now podcast host Michael Moore, who won an Oscar in 2004 and took to the stage at that ceremony, which took place less than a week after the invasion of Iraq had begun. In his speech, he made clear that this invasion was wrong and should not be happening, which gained quite a few cheers, but also some boos, and the orchestra interrupted his speech to get it over with quicker. Afterwards, Moore was subjected to an absolute onslaught of hate and intolerance in the US media, with accusations of betraying America and their precious troops at a time when all alternative views were expected to be shut out of public discourse, and thanks to a cowardly and usually billionaire-owned media, it was. Some commentators even speculate about his death being a good thing. The result of his defiance was even more extreme, as Moore had to hire professional security guards after his life was threatened to guard him and his home around the clock. This included a right-wing head case coming to his house, or at least one occasion. At one point, a plot was even uncovered to actually bomb his home. They literally raided the home of a fella that they found building these bombs, and he had material and information which pointed out that he was planning to put it in Michael Moore's house. The Bush administration and the right-wing news sites, who had worked to make him into a public enemy, never commented on this, nor retracted any of their attacks against him. Nor, for that matter, were they actually even asked. They were never really pushed about it. It was something that they avoided, even though they were directly responsible for it. This is effectively, as far as I'm concerned, they kind of almost tried to put out a hit on him, as in a manner of speaking, and never actually faced any, consequences for actually doing that. A third example of these times, a casualty of these times, was Bill Maher. On his TV show Politically Incorrect, on an episode airing a week after 9/11, he commented that calling the plane hijackers cowards was wrong, as they had followed their beliefs literally to the point of death, while US forces had been the real cowards, launching cruise missiles from hundreds of miles away, so they did not have to get their hands dirty doing actual real killing and real work. They also killed plenty of civilians and others in the process. The response to this was that he lost his job and the show was shut down. Interestingly, the right-winger Dinesh D'Souza was also on the show saying exactly the same things, but he was not cancelled and today makes terrible films and as a side hustle pretends that he is also being cancelled. He never stood up for Maher nor took any of the slack despite his love of being a cancel martyr. Maybe he hadn't grown into it by that point, that was a ways down the line. So a TV show, literally called Politically Incorrect, was cancelled because the presenter said something deemed politically unsayable. The host of the show called out the Empire for their crimes, for once, and felt that their increasing power over the world of culture, and felt their increasing power over the world of the culture around him as a result. Now, while Marl is an Islamophobe and a smug twat and somebody that I have absolutely no time for, in fact, somebody I hate, really, in this case, he didn't actually deserve to lose his job. Commenting on the situation at the time, the then White House Press Secretary, Ari Fleischer, said that people in America need to watch what they say and watch what they do from now on. That was his basic message to the American people. Land of the free, home of free speech. He, on the other hand, was one of the people lying about Iraq in order to perpetrate a war that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, possibly over a million, and he has never served a day in prison like his bosses. He and his vile kind created a climate of Islamophobia and damaged and in some cases ended the lives of innocent civilians. And yet today, he and his fellow former government extremists are still featured in the media and have full establishment credentials. Some even have cushy media jobs, including commenting on the state of the world today, which is basically in much of the state that it is because of the actions that they took when they were in power. In Britain, there were similar tactics, if usually. Oh, sorry, before I move on, there was one other example I said, didn't I? Phil Donahue was another one who had been on TV in America for some time with a TV show, fairly crap one in my opinion, but nevertheless. And he basically mentioned on his show that he thought the war was wrong and shouldn't be happening. Again, similar situation, got shut down, got fired, got cancelled, whatever you want to call it. So, as I was saying, in Britain, there were very similar tactics, if less theatrical. Journalists were fired and made scapegoats for defiance when investigating the reasons for the wars, while as ever, the left, generally anti-war from the start, were completely shut out of public life, marginalised and mocked, seen again as traitors for not supporting soldiers on their endless killing sprees in poor countries of brown people. The mainstream news did not even carry an alternative view to war and mass killing for a very long time. While there were less obvious personalities attacked in Britain, the effect was the same and plenty of dissenters were vilified in the press. To this day, we have seen left-wing people attacked, often violently, in the street. And this has yet to happen to a total scumfuck like Lawrence Fox, for instance, although I know he wishes it would, because then he'd get the full martyr treatment. What we're talking about here was real cancel culture. And it still stands as examples of how extreme the mainstream is willing to go. To this day, it is far more threatening to your daily life to be a well-known left-winger, a trans person or an ally of trans people, or still to this day, even a Muslim, than it is to be any kind of right-winger. The people who get attacked in the streets are not the people who are on TV now, on radio now, every other bloody place now, whining about being cancelled, even though you keep seeing their face and hearing their voice. It's a funny kind of cancellation. What is most interesting to me is my first political awakening was actually based around censorship. As a teenage hip-hop fan, I was constantly fighting battles of freedom of expression to those around me, while the artists I liked were suffering extreme and mainstream attacks for the things they wanted to discuss on record. Usually this involved telling the truth about the horror of everyday life for black people and poor people living in the USA. But of course, you're not really supposed to talk about that unless there's money in it. There was plenty of similar things here in Britain too, as tabloids and TV screamed of an underclass and specifically non-white criminals creating a world of violent chaos for lovely white people. The press themselves creating a well-controlled climate of fear. It's kind of their specialty. When they were not picking on black people, they scapegoated single mothers, for instance, again, with no recourse to respond. They weren't, you know, talking to the people for whom they were effectively victimizing. I think I can't remember the guy's name, but there was at the Conservative Party conference in 1993. There was some forgotten Tory politician who made a really fierce, brutal and unpleasant speech against single mothers. It was quite shocking. Around the same time, a bizarre onslaught began against violent films of a type, that is, or anything that fell into a certain bracket that was deemed unsuitable for everyone, including adults, to watch in certain formats, mainly on home video. Basically, this was the time of the big video ban. During this time, which was, I suppose, roughly between about 1992 and 1994, more or less, a number of films were withheld a video certificate by the BBFC, effectively banned on video to be watched by anyone, such as I said, consenting adults, within their own homes. This was all part of the hard right agenda of the John Major government, trying to force a backward political and social culture onto modern Britain. And the result was, of course, lots of programme makers watching what they did and said for fear of legal repercussions. The initial excuse for this was tied up with the brutal and deeply disturbing murder of a toddler named James Bulger, whose killers were about 10 years old at the time. The country seemed to have great trouble dealing with this and shut down any real discourse or discussion of why it could have happened. Instead of a mature and sensible public discussion about what might have led to two children, incidentally from very poor backgrounds, committing such a brutal and truly senseless murder, the increasingly draconian government of Major decided to focus on culture as if the problem were there and shut it down access to films, incidentally, that I usually really wanted to watch. A whole bunch of films of varying quality suddenly joined the equally baffling list of long time banned on video films like The Exorcist and Straw Dogs that the heavy-handed BBFC had decided needed to be kept away from us impressionable minds. Apparently all of us are rather too impressionable to see these films. So there was a little bit of a history too in the 80s here in Britain. I don't know if you're old enough to remember it, or maybe you're listening to us outside of this country, in which a lot of things were banned on video. They called them the video nasties. So it was mostly horror films, but other such stuff that was getting released. And it was being released kind of uncertificated. And as I have some of you, actually, Dave, you might as well jump in here. Do you remember this period at all?
Well, I remember the bad old 80s where we had the... America was literally buying nuclear weapons and bankrupting the USSR. At the time, and literally did bankrupt because it was called the arms race, and it was basically who's got more nuclear weapons. And Reagan, or the Republican Party at that time, or Ronald Reagan, just made them bankrupt, and they had to come to some sort of arrangement around about 87. But what's happened with America's super shopping spree of nuclear arms, they are now buried in the Nevada desert with an expiry date of 1,000 years. And we forget, it probably is not being advertised or hasn't been advertised at the time. No one questioned, Congress never questioned, the UK never questioned what we're going to do with this nuclear arms, these nuclear warheads. And yeah, just imagine that, they're sitting buried in the Nevada desert and won't expire until 1,000 years. So that's quite frightening, because there's no regulation there. It's not even regulated. There's minimal regulation. There's minimal security. It's just, you know, when you think about that. So, the consequences of such decisions, it's crazy, and we just don't learn. We just don't learn. Vietnam, don't learn. World War One, don't learn. World War Two, don't learn. Vietnam, Cambodia, Iraq, Afghanistan, we just don't learn. John?
Yeah, and interesting examples you say at the end there, being anti-war in public culture, and particularly if you are, I know there's always that cheap accusation of you're being unpatriotic and against the troops. Which they normally, or against the soldiers, we normally say that word in this country. And people throw that around as it's kind of a way of kind of shutting down your debate or your point. A lot of people, especially in politics, run scared of that, which is one of the reasons why I've never gone into politics. I am very overtly anti-war and more than happy to be anti-soldier. And that is something which absolutely gets, probably still to this day, but certainly in the period of time we're talking about in this country, would have absolutely got you cancelled, if not killed. The jingoistic mindset, again, doing what Britain always does best, which is trying to emulate America, it just went absolutely crazy. It was beyond.
Well, I remember Harold Wilson. Harold Wilson was absolutely slaughtered in the 60s because obviously he did put it to the vote in Parliament to support America and Vietnam and Cambodia, but he didn't push it, and obviously it lost the vote. And in actual fact, in 2014 or 13. Bombing Libya didn't get the vote, but then he called the vote again in 2015. As the vote was going through, the planes were on its way to Libya. That worked out well, didn't it? I mean, They've just created a vacuum of power there that all sorts of factions are trying to take over the country. As one good political or military analyst said about the Middle East, I do remember rightly, and China, which is in the spotlight now because they suspect China and Iran are on the West's radar. And he said, and he fought in many, unfortunately, he said many conflicts. He said, I wouldn't go there. You're never going to win. Never going to happen. We're not built for it. We're not trained for it. These people have got minimal equipment and they will win. Stay out of it. Right? Because there's repercussions of that. That's all I'm saying. John?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to come back to some of that stuff later on if we have time. I've got something planned for a future show talking about the likes of Cameron and them starting wars. Excuse me 2 seconds. I think I'm going to sneeze. No, I'm not. That's good. Okay. Yeah. And et cetera, et cetera. And also as you know, we've discussed and I'll probably mention it again later. I don't particularly care for armchair hard men or people who think they understand anything from epidemiology to military strategy. But if there's one form of military strategy that I really think all of us can absolutely adopt with great confidence, because history shows us multiple examples of this, don't try and fight civil war in somebody else's country, because you will not ever win. As Dave has already mentioned this evening, Vietnam, Libya, Syria, et cetera, et cetera. Libya, a country which now basically has open-air slave markets again, among other things, and as you said, an absolute total and complete power vacuum. Totally disastrous area. No justification for that conflict. Yes, a bad man was thrown out of power and murdered. Well, yeah, but so what? There's plenty of other bad men. Why do you just pick these particular ones in order to try and make some kind of cheap political capital, which is a reason Cameron did it, and one of the many things I'm disgusted with him getting away with it.
Well, one thing we want to be clear about, Tracks FM, and mine and John's views, pretty much, we don't want any soldier going in. We don't hate our country. We just don't want people to, and young boys, by the way, the young boys, if you, even the famous N-N-N-19, all that was famous, but Paul Hardcastle felt very strongly about those young kids going over to Vietnam. We're not advocates of young boys going over to die for no reason whatsoever, for no gain whatsoever, politically or otherwise. If you look at the whole history of the Middle East, Saddam Hussein survived two presidents, tenure in the US. You know, it didn't do anyone any good anyhow, you know, And stop hiding behind this nationalism, because it turns me off personally. This nationalism stuff. Because it don't compensate when those boys are disfigured or die. And no support whatsoever forever. And there's a big study now with the post-traumatic stress disorder. And the support that those people have who fight for the flag and all that, which is what the mainstream media, and bear in mind, mainstream media, that started quite early. I think the BBC were created, I think it was World War One, but definitely World War Two. They were created as a propaganda machine for World War Two. And all they did is show propaganda on World War Two. What they didn't show was those young boys dying, those young children dying. John?
Yeah, and that is, of course, another aspect of the media, especially in America, that they, from the Gulf War of the 90s onwards, they made absolutely sure that the military controlled what was coming out image-wise as best they possibly could from that country, because they knew very well the damage it had done to them during Vietnam. It's one of the things, the actual evening news doing its job properly was one of the things that helped to stop that war. Didn't stop it quick enough, and it wasn't as simple as that, but that's absolutely an element that was involved in it. I truly believe that. And look, my attitude towards the army is very simple. No one's forcing you to join it, so don't join it. It says something about your character if you're willing to do so. I'm not actually saying that quite often you're talking about people who come from really piss poor parts of the country that can't afford to get on with their life in any other way. I understand that, and I'm not judging it. But if you join that, you must know that you're going somewhere to kill somebody at some point. And you're not going to get out of the responsibility of that. I'm going to put that moral responsibility upon you as best I can. But then, yeah, I mean, when it to sum that position up, basically, if you want to support the troops and support Stop the War. It's as simple as that. That's the only meaningful thing you can do to help your precious boys, is not send them into another ridiculous conflict time and time again.
Well, it's interesting, John, in the 60s, which was the 60s for me in America, was a very important time for me, and I studied it. Because from a boxing point of view, so they had two Cassius Clays, right, which they hated. There was two, right, because when he won the Olympic gold and realised that he still wasn't going to be welcome in his local restaurant and had to sit in the segregated section, and he actually started getting up and saying, I'm the greatest, I'm the greatest, I'm pretty, I'm the greatest. And as Malcolm X said at the time, he scared the establishment, part one of Cassius Clay. Because as Malcolm X said, and this is his words, they were scared because all the other, and he said this, not me, Negroes will be all standing up going, I'm the greatest, I'm pretty, I'm the greatest. He said they scared them, A. B, he took a stand against Vietnam War, saying that I wouldn't go to, why would I go and kill other brown people when I can't even get rights here as American? And he scared the establishment. And they took his license away, and which was unlawful, illegal by all accounts. And they were putting him in, they were threatening to put him in jail. That's how nationalistic it was. And to be honest, I think he was a reason that a lot of people at that time, coming up to 1970 and 1971, started realizing, hey, he may be right here. And I do remember a Californian senator at the time saying, because he wanted a license to fight because they took his right to earn. And a Californian senator said, I will never give that, and this is his words, that nigger a license. That was Ronald Reagan, who went on to be president. Because it was so nationalistic, the country was split in half because of this flag stuff and all that, and we didn't realise by 1976, 78, we were looking at thousands and thousands of soldiers coming back with no arms, no legs, and no support. What's that Tom Cruise film? 4th of July.
All on the 4th of July.
I watch it now and then, but I can't watch it all the time, John, because I find it really depressing.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember the guy's full name, but Ron someone. He was an activist. He was one of the kind of most high profile veterans against war activists. And again, was attacked even while sitting in his wheelchair. Was attacked as a traitor and a commie and all this.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think that the American public got that idea just by sitting in the chair and just thinking. They were watching a lot of nationalistic crap.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, they were. But also, by the way, Dave, Muhammad Ali's, or Clay as he was in those days, was a classic example of cancel culture. Absolutely right. It was cancelled because he's prevented from earning a living because he would not toe the line and do what he was supposed to, because he wouldn't be not only a sportsman saying what he was supposed to say, but a black man doing and saying what he was supposed to say in America at that time. He wouldn't do it. And so they shut him down.
Yeah, the establishment has created a new word. They created a whole new... He wasn't just a black American, which was segregated, couldn't eat in the same... He wasn't just that. They created a whole label for him. And this is an interesting two words that was created just for Muhammad Ali. And those two words were, and they created it, black Muslims. I don't understand that. How is that, how is that a thing? Black Muslims. Sorry... I don't get that. Say that again. Is that a separate country? Black Muslim. Just the word Muslim, which in America in the 60s, if you said to someone a Muslim, they would have thought it was a cloth at that time. So how they labelled him and those who were fighting against oppression in their own country was, let's call them black Muslims. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. Anyway, so just leaping back to where we left off, we were talking about films being banned on video in this country, particularly in the early 90s specifically, and how that had joined a list of other long-time banned films like The Exorcist and Straw Dogs, which all of which are available now. This frankly mad state of affairs was brought about by tabloid speculation that the killers of young James Bulger had watched unsuitable horror films at home due to terrible parenting, etc. In reality, this was part of the political push to blame everything on individual responsibility and remove the state and its specific political management from any responsibility in anything that ever happens to any of us. But it's hard to explain, I think, to younger people today, the truly backward state of affairs where one film after another was deemed not so much to be violent, but the wrong kind of violent. And it was banned from video shops as this would, as if this would have ever had any meaningful effect anyway. It certainly made cinema repeats and pirate videos very popular, while blaming everything on personal responsibility and nothing on society or on its loudest practitioners, such as politicians and the media. How very, very mature of all of them. Meanwhile, mainstream films were increasingly violent and sent the message of the dangerous world that we lived in that had to be protected by John McClane or the FBI or later on Jack Bauer, all of whom are terrible people in the phony world of McClane and Bauer and in the real world of the FBI. People who kill without conscience and face no consequences for doing so, but are seen by our political and cultural establishment as necessary to uphold some concepts of freedom that at best only applies to those rich enough with the lightest skin. What you actually had here was a scenario that was scaring powers that be because they didn't have a big bad enemy anymore and they couldn't shove their money into the military industrial complex quite as easily as they used to be able to, but they appear to have got over that. Today we have Marvel superheroes keeping us safe from imaginary dangers, in the process reflecting the real world equivalents of pretend heroes fighting pretend threats. In the world of film now, you will struggle to find anything that portrays a police or armed forces or even the security services as villains. At best, you get the one rogue member of the force, but not the entire force itself as it is in real life. I think this is reflective of certain changes in society that artists and creative types, along with everyone else really, are still quite scared to challenge. Britain has attempted to shut away so much of our terrible history that I wonder if even a film like In the Name of the Father would end up getting made today. Now, just a little point on this about some of the culture. It is worth remembering, you know, you might be sitting there quite rightly thinking, why are you mentioning kind of phony characters that don't exist, like Jack Bauer and John McClane? Well, I totally agree. The problem is that they do end up entering into our cultural mindset, into the wider ideas around the time, in which, in a kind of strange way, and maybe we should focus on this entirely one week, in kind of a strange way, the reality and the fantasy kind of meld into each other. I mean, it's well worth remembering, as Dave already mentioned, Reagan. Reagan basically used Rambo, as Americans did at that time. Rambo was, of course, a character who, in his later incarnations, ended up winning the Vietnam War. And also one of the films, along with Missing in Action, including the first Rambo film, First Blood, I think is actually quite a good film, but I do hold a great deal of resentment against it. And one of the reasons is that film, like Missing in Action, perpetrated a couple of myths about Vietnam, which entered into the real world mindset. Those two myths were, in Missing in Action's case, it was about people who had been left behind, which was also what Rambo First Blood Part 2 was about, Americans who have been left behind in Vietnam, and those terrible people in Congress weren't telling you about it. The other myth they put forward was, as Rambo himself says at the end of First Blood, nobody let us win. We could have won, but they wouldn't let us win. And when I came home, there were all of these hippies spitting at me, calling me a baby killer. Total and utter bullshit. Didn't happen. Okay, simple as that. But they were perpetrated by into the real world mindset by these films. That's just how they connected together. So, you know, they ran around the place trying to ban Child's Play 3 on video in this country because they claimed the Bulger killers had seen it, and then wrote an incredibly tenuous article about how certain things that happened in that film are connected to what they did. So you want to ban a film about a pretend killer doll running around, but you don't actually want to stop the films that are advocating.
I've never seen that Child's Play. I've no interest in it whatsoever.
Pretty average film, to be honest, though. First one's, I don't know, it was all right. It's quite unique. The rest of them are just...
So are you saying you watched Child's Play?
Yeah, I had the first one on video when I was a kid. That's why I was so intensely violent all the time. That's why I used to, you know, torture all the other kids in my local neighbourhood.
Because of Child's Play?
Yeah, while I got this, also I used to get a shit beat out of it. No, it's It's all right, mate. It's a very average
film. I think the most horrific film I've seen, scariest, and I shouldn't have read the book when I was seven. Yeah. Bear in mind, I read the book when I was seven. And it's, at the time, I'm sorry, this is not a political section of the show at all or anything. But the most scariest film at that time, and the book when I read it, was Exorcist.
Yeah, very scary, sure.
That was freaked me out. Because things like that just freak me out. Because it's the unknown, isn't it?
It is, but yeah. To be honest, I think the most frightening film I've seen came out a few years ago. It's an Australian film called Snowtown, also known as the Snowtown Murders. And it's about a real-life serial killer and how he was able to, basically through a sense of charm and ideas about who did and didn't deserve to live, was effectively able to carry out a number of killings in the neighbourhood that he lived in. I genuinely found it really...
Yeah, things like that. When there's a bit of realism, another one that freaks me out, scary, and I've even watched a court case online, you know, you get the transcripts, and it wasn't the new 10 Rillington Place, the BBC show. The one that freaked me out was the one with Attenborough played...
Richard Attenborough, yeah,
That is horrible. I find that scary even now, because where it was based, and they made it look so real, and it was actually filmed in the same house and the same street, and it was so real. It was that freaks me out, actually. A little bit like the film you mentioned from Australia. It freaks me out.
Yeah, very good film, and Attenborough is brilliant. For those that aren't maybe so familiar with his screen career, he's a very good actor, but probably even better director. But he didn't normally play roles like that, and so it was really, I agree with you, incredibly creepy film, very effective. But anyway, so censorship. So this censorship we're talking about with films later advanced towards video games. Again, we were told that the more violent end of these were bad for our children's mental health, except the army ones, of course, some of which were genuinely used as recruitment tools for the armed forces, specifically in America, using the usual horrible tropes of dehumanized Muslim people on the rampage as the eternal baddies and telling the player that they were the knights in shining armor coming to rescue the white women and American values. You could even go into battle at midnight in Iraq to terrorize and murder civilians, blasting out the very same Marilyn Manson albums that back home in the States you were told led to school shootings. This is how the great empire put itself out into the world with its British lapdog yapping behind, and this was how we entered the 21st century. All of this was possible because of the presence of the most vile, repulsive aspect of modern society and culture, perhaps even not modern culture, that I have actually ever seen in my life. The one thing above all that I hate beyond redemption or any degree of being able to understand it. And that, folks, is sentimentality. From boomers onwards, generations of sad people full of rage because they did not have a great war of liberation to define them. In fact, the only wars we have seen since have all been aggression from those that at this side of the fence and that demanded that we see them as heroes. None of these conflicts have been justifiable, but all were rigidly celebrated, and those who dissented were viciously attacked, and most commonly they used sentimental tropes, as we've mentioned already this evening, about dead soldiers and their sacrifice. A perfect little excuse for barbarism around the world that seemed, for the most part, unarguable, or inarguable, depending on how you pronounce that word. After all, do you want to be the one that tells parents of fallen soldiers that their child's loss was pointless? It seems we have left that job to history instead. In fact, throwing around the memory of your dead loved ones is pretty profitable. You can get on all sorts of media platforms and end an argument, despite being wrong all of the time, just by bringing this up. People with the most repellent views and points are totally devoid of a sensible argument, have been in the press and on our screens for years because nobody had the guts to tell them that they were stupid or wrong. In fact, they just roll in fear, basically, that they would just roll out their my son, stroke daughter, stroke husband, stroke dog was killed excuse. All of this furthers for me our recent discussion on the show about maturity. We discussed it last week, or rather a gross lack of it. Coupled with an inability to face consequences of their actions, we are left in a world of sentimental monsters and unable to escape their terrible clutches. And also, by the way, the other reason I hate sentimentality, as Dave and myself both mentioned this evening again, is nationalism. Patriotism, all of those things are based entirely on utterly pathetic, dribbling sentimentality. Oh God, I hate it so much. I don't have the words, but let's move on. You know, let's talk about the new grind that we're seeing emerge now in our culture. Comedians who are simply finding their tired material is not appealing to younger audiences anymore, or new audiences, no longer have the dignity to drift into obscurity, nor the indignity to feature in increasingly terrible reality TV shows. But instead, they get around to claiming that they are being persecuted by a new age of hypersensitive youth who simply do not understand older people's humour or values. The woke brigade has arrived. Drum roll, please. This has laid the groundwork for plenty of other terrible creatures to do similar, including the increasingly demented anti-trans movement, whose hatred towards their chosen victims is equaled only by their own sense of victimhood whenever anybody disagrees with them. They know from experience, as we discussed earlier, that only threats to their safety are going to allow them to create this fantasy. But unfortunately for them, this doesn't happen much. So they make it up instead, trying to convince you that the sort of treatment that happened to Michael Moore is happening to them, whether it's Rosie Duffield or Graham Linehan or any of those other freaks. As they tour around one TV studio after one radio studio after another YouTube channel, claiming to have been shut down and prevented from expressing their views. When such people are called out, be they media types, columnists or politicians, their position of victim is often legitimised as the media follows suit and treats them like this, taking everything they say seriously and effectively on face value. What they never do, however, is ask trans people about the effects this promotion of intolerance has had on them and their lives, which has frequently included violent attacks in the streets and similar such abuse, none of which is generally experienced by the media figures who perpetrate this hate in the first place. Now, it's worth checking out a recent show, of course, that we did where I had attended a Queer Night Pride Take Back the Night demo, where you can hear a lot of speeches from trans people, the kind of people who don't ever get platformed on mainstream media in any way. You can hear them talk about their life experiences in a climate where hate crime has gone up by at least 20% in the last year or so. Give you an idea of the kind of thing that they're genuinely facing. You know, that is the real world aspect of it. Anyway, we are going to revisit the anti-trans movement, sadly, in a later show, because I want to talk about the kind of the modern far right and how it intersects with anti-trans bigotry and anti-vax sentiment and all that kind of stuff. So we'll leave that there for now. Don't worry, if you're thinking that I've only given them a slight beating, don't worry, they're going to get an absolute thrashing in coming weeks. So I suppose moving into the kind of conclusion of the main aspect of tonight's show. As many regular listeners know, I hate living in the past and all aspects of nostalgia, especially the bloody sentimentality. I would argue looking back to the cultural position of 20 years ago, however, and seeing where we went wrong is the right kind of remembering. It reminds us of the climate of that time, how it was responded to, and therefore how we got to where we are today. What you see looking at this time, and plenty before it really, as a few good examples Dave's pointed out this evening, is that cancel culture is comparatively not even a thing today. Okay, now I understand this is a tad more nuanced on the left, where we have real debates and intellectual engagement. I understand there is people who advocate there is some strong degree of a type of cancel culture happening today, a real one, where people are being, you know, fired and whatever else. Well, I'm happy to open the channels to anyone smart enough to kind of make that argument very well, and maybe in future you can come on the show. But certainly my position at the moment is that cancel culture is comparatively not even a thing today. Please challenge me if you wish to. I assure you I'll let you speak, don't worry, I won't jump in and talk over you. It's not how we do things here. So, as I say, not really a thing in my opinion as it's so much today. In fact, it was far harsher then, and those claiming the most loudly, they're not the exclusive preserve today, are self-victimising right-wingers who are angry because they lost the culture war a long time ago, and they know it. They miss a world where anyone, politician, media personality, pop star, or even football pundit could be destroyed by them and their media arms for thinking and expressing an alternative viewpoint. Today, in effect, they still have this power and can launch it towards anyone or anything that directly threatens their power. But they are losing the power slowly and surely, and they know it. Nobody under 50 is reading their rags anymore, nor watching their shitty low-quality news programs, and do not give important status to low-rank members of acting families who think rather too much of themselves or simply can't get ahead in the world of acting. We need to make sure that this state of affairs, as it is there, continues. we need to lean on the throat of every conservative, on the throat of the Murdoch Empire, on the throat of the transphobes and the Islamophobes and the real anti-Semites, all those terrible people. We have to break the terrible conditioning of people in this country and further afield. Not something being helped by certain opposition political parties right now who are determined to destroy the left, their own youthful membership, and hark back to the politics of the time we've actually been discussing this week. Not possible, and even if it were, not desirable, to say the least. If needs be, we junk the political system and now and replace it with one that gives us, the people, all of the powers that we need, including the power to change and control our own lives. But we must be as harsh to our enemies as they have been to us. The establishment order runs deep and we must break free, but we must also focus this in the right places. Work is still the dominant force within our lives, and overcoming the terrifying direction that this has gone in recent times remains the key to freedom. It all connects, so let's get to work on this. So, Dave, that's the main body of what I want to say tonight. Please give me your views.
No, as long as you don't slag off Wigfield Saturday night, I'll give him sugar. S Club 7, Backstreet Boys.
Wigfield and all of her other hits.
And Christine...
Aguilera. Yeah. Aguilera.
But you would also favour the 90s hip-hop as well. I know you would.
Would you know, I got to say, actually, I kind of tuned out a little bit in the late 90s. I tuned out a bit. It's a long story. I won't tell you. It involves quite a lot of breakdown. But I wasn't listening to it so much in the late 90s. And now I do find some of these like underground hip-hop mixes on YouTube that I find very enlightening. There's some fantastic tunes on there.
It's just such a difference from... not slagging off today's hip-hop. I'm just saying, me and John have said, that it was such a wonderful time of hip hop at that time. You had different introductions to different artists, Dennis Coffey, and I forgot to say so many. John Davis Monster Band, James Brown, so many independent soul artists that they were sampling, and they introduced us to it, and it was a wonderful time, and it taught us a lot, you know, about soul music, and it just disappeared, John. It's a shame, really.
Yeah,
probably because corporatism stopped sampling, but there you go.
Well, that is true. Yeah, the market stepped in to regulate when it feels like it. That's for sure, and that's a very good example. I mean, you couldn't get Paul's Boutique made now, could you? You couldn't get 3 Feet High and Rising made because they sample far too heavily.
Yeah, it's interesting that. Anita Baker, after all these years, I know she's a R&B soul singer from the 80s, and she just managed after, because she disappeared, you know, she was a very successful soul R&B artist with Warners. Like Prince, she just after, she disappeared for about 30 years, and just won her court battle to own her own music.
Yeah.
That is crazy. I mean, you know... What's going on, you know? Music is slavery, you know?
I was talking to someone about this the other day, actually, and this person was saying to me, you know, do you remember the Word? I said, yeah, the TV show on Channel 4 in the 90s, which basically had two things going for it. One was the fact it had an amazing array of music that was not really available in Britain. It wasn't as commonly shown as it was in, you know, you had like the first TV performances in Britain of Nirvana, you had Rage Against the Machine, you had Cypress Hill. You had an amazing Cypress Hill performance, actually, because just a slight deviation. They did Insane in the Brain at the opening of the show, and then just kind of wandered over to the sofa and did an interview. It's so cool, so children would act. It's amazing. But anyway, you had that, and there was also the opportunity to see some nudity, which for those of us who were teenagers at the time and didn't have the internet in those days was something we very much wanted to do on a Friday night. So we watched this show fairly well, even though it was a terrible program and really badly presented by people who I mostly come to like more as they got older. But anyway... but the question of why, you know, you're not likely to see this in many other places outside of YouTube rips is because of the whole rights issue. So if you wanted to release the Nirvana performance, you've basically got to pay whoever it is, I think mostly Courtney Love, who owns so much of the rights to Nirvana's stuff now. You know, you'd have to pay them a certain amount, which, there's a debate to be had about that. Steve Albini has some very interesting views on getting repeatedly paid for somebody else's work being played, but also, you know, how else the musicians, certainly at the lower levels, going to actually get paid properly. So let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, is kind of my view on it. But yeah, it prevents that program from being released properly because you've just got a number of rights issues. And that's one of the funny things in the world of music. You owe everybody everything to some degree or another all the bloody time. It's quite madness inducing, really. And what it doesn't do is for folks like us to get hold of our music. So if on the rare off chance, because if we're talking about late 90s, early 2000s, hip hop that I do love, it's everything related to Def Jux. And so on the very rare, you know, possibility that LP is listening, please release the Company Flow album Fun Crusher Plus, because I can't afford to pay 30 quid for a CD of the existing version. Also, that I'd end up treating it like a bloody relic rather than actually, you know, treating it as something I wanted to play. So please re-release it. Sorry, I don't know if that answers some of your point there, Dave.
It's a fair point, and it's great that you're asking for CDs to be released, because it just makes a difference from Spotify and all the stuff that people are using.
Some of us old people still like CDs.
Yeah. Right, you carry on, John, because I've got a slight emergency, but nothing major. Carry on.
Okay, mate. Well, what I'll do, I've just got one little thing I want to talk about, and while you're doing your emergency, hopefully you can hear me. This is something I kind of put on the back burner for this week, right, because I wanted to think about this in a much wider, I think it's a much wider issue. But, you know, this is one of the beauties of this kind of program, is we can always come back to things. But I wanted to think about why we are so willing to adhere to perhaps the state of affairs that I've talked about this week, but not only that, just the whole situation. So, for instance, here in Britain, where a government that has presided over, at best, the total mishandling, and at worst, the mass death of hundreds of thousands of people in the last year and a half under COVID through their total ineptitude, corruption, and just downright indecency, and how they still manage to be higher in the polls of people would vote for. Now, there's you know, reasons for that. Some of them are based on Keir Starmer being totally useless. Some of them are based on, in the words of Henry Rollins, you know, when the going gets tough, the average get conservative. And we've had very, very tough times last year. But also, I believe there's a weird mindset that many, many people adopt kind of unknowingly, and that's a kind of mindset of domination. It runs pretty deep, especially in Britain, and it has far worse consequences than might be obvious at first viewing. It intersects with a lot of other mental hang-ups, specifically over class, but also often involving sex, specifically abuse within institutions such as public schools and whatnot. And it also has within it an inherent death drive. Basically, too many people like being dominated, specifically by their supposed class superiors. So, as I said, in Britain, we've seen some of the worst handling of COVID-19 in the world, and one of the absolute worst in Europe. Yet some people will still advocate for the government and their utterly corrupt cronies, you know, taking tons of public money into their own pockets, not even delivering the services they were asked to. One explanation for this, I believe, is in the psychological state that says because of the class position of Johnson and Rees-Mogg and the rest of them, that they must rule even if it kills us. We must be dominated by them. This is some kind of natural order. Until this kind of program is fully broken, I don't think we will ever truly overcome. And I think ultimately we can't move forward. So that also answers something. I was going to say a quick personal moment. A friend of both of ours, Dave, who I was in conversation with via text the other week, who was despairing and asking me where it's going, and I said I'd email him my response to it. Part of my response is that, Steve, in order to overcome the modern world's terrible scenario, we have to overcome this belief in us being ruled, controlled, dominated by our supposed class superiors. You simply can't ignore this anymore. You can't go forward. You know, I know none of us here are minimizing other aspects of identity and how they intersect. I'm actually quite a big fan of intersectionality. It's, again, it's a bit of a buzzword, and a lot of people who use it don't really know what it means. But I think that the way things intersect is really, in many ways, a lot of the kind of stuff we go into on this show regularly, you know, how the world intersects in the way that it does. So, you know, I think that is absolutely the case. Nobody's trying to minimize anything. But we have to face the reality of class structure. We have to face the reality of why, you know, you talk about area, this kind of way where people get resentment if they come from an area outside of, say, London or Manchester or Birmingham, they have this resentment towards the cities because of underfunding. Well, I understand that, but nowhere is it going to benefit. Okay, firstly, you're ignoring the deep grinding poverty that exists within those cities and many other places. Secondly, you are never going to actually make anything better or benefit anything by bringing us all down a level. The point is to bring us up. I mean, that's what people like myself and Dave, among other things, do as trade unionists. That's the point. We're not looking to go, oh, well, you see, the problem is, folks, that like Ofcom said, you know, too many of us in our company have better terms and conditions than they do in all the other delivery companies. Therefore, we should reduce ourselves to their level. No, that's not the argument. No, we think they should bring themselves up to our level. A substantially better state of affairs. That's the whole idea. You can't get anywhere, nor do I think you should, because I think it's immoral, to argue that actually everyone else should suffer just like I do. I think it's petty and vile and repulsive. And so we need to ditch that. We need to ditch the desire to be dominated. And dear God, all flipping mighty, we need to ditch the god-awful sentimentality, which has never brought us anything good whatsoever. Dave, are you available or are you still?
Yeah, it wasn't a big emergency. It's just I was called upstairs and I got three flights. Me walking up three flights is an emergency.
I'm glad you managed to get back in time. Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realise you were broadcasting from the basement. I thought you were. I imagined you on the roof with an aerial.
Oh, I miss those days, John.
Yes, because those were the days.
I miss those.
The real pirate days.
Yeah. In the snow and the rain and holding aerials up. Oh, I miss those days. It never leaves you.
No, it doesn't. No. Having to check your aerial in case somebody else had smashed it up.
You mentioned the word, because I do remember one particular, and it's not necessarily nationalistic or racist. It's more about culture and culture across many different parts of the world. And it was when Mark Lamar challenged Shabba Ranks.
Yes.
LGBT anti-LGBT record he released, because as I said, the West Indies are way behind on LGBT stuff, and I do remember vividly him challenging, and I think Shabba Ranks was dropped from his label because he signed with Sony at the time, because he was very popular at the time, and he was challenged on the word over that, and I don't think it was scripted at all, but it was just like matter of fact to Shabba, you know.
Yeah, I remember that well. It was I didn't really get the kind of meaningful importance of it at the time because I was a bit disconnected from that sort of stuff. But yeah, if I remember rightly, it was a feature they'd done on Bougie Banton, who'd written Boom Biddy Bye Bye or whatever, which is very homophobic. And Shabba Ranks was in the studio and they asked him what he thought about it. And he basically talked about gay people being crucified or stuff. I mean, I have a lot of, obviously, you know, shock horror, I have problems with that viewpoint. But what I have even more so is that in that interview, and I think further interviews, he quoted the Bible, this, that, and the other. And it's kind of like, mate, you're from Jamaica, and the only reason you have Christianity there is because white people forced you at knife point and other such things to take it on. So I was, to me, it kind of opened up another argument that perhaps I don't have, as a white bloke, have exactly the social comfortableness to discuss this entirely. But I'm not going to lie to you, Dave. It's my views are in the way that I find it very upsetting and very heartbreaking. Again, I'm not having a go at people who have Christian belief. But when you see people in parts of Africa or Caribbean or anywhere else talking about, God says this and God says that. It's like, the only reason you believe this shit is because you were forced to. I'm sorry, that's just true. It was forced upon you. And there needs to be some recognition of that, especially when it leads to the gross homophobia that you're talking about that Mr. Ranks was showing.
Yeah, and again, I was really uncomfortable with it because I thought that such views, what does it differ to someone who says that black and Asian people are different from us and should be, you know, it's the same thing.
Exactly.
I saw. And even at the time, I was living in Northwest London, which was in the midst of that debate as well. But even at that time, I thought, hey, I'm not comfortable with what he's saying, you know. not comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, that idea of, you know, we don't just need unity because it's the right thing to do. It's also, you know, for those of you out there that love logic and trying to win arguments with it, I mean, exactly what Dave's saying right there is going, like, how can you, you know, argue and advocate that you have rights as a black person that shouldn't be persecuted as they have been throughout history, and then go, but actually it's okay to do it to these people over here. You know, you've got to stand up for the Jewish people, for the gay people, for the trans people, etc. You know, you have to stand up.
I think he lost his argument in his first three words, you know. Anyway,
well, he lost the history too, mate. That's well, worth remembering.
Exactly.
You know, the homophobes have lost. This is the thing, I'll just close with this. This is the thing that's worth remembering. You know, as again, about this ridiculous idea of culture wars, these raging, whinging right-wing leftovers, they know they've lost. That's why they're so angry. Anyway, go on.
Anyway, many thanks, John.
Thank you.
We'll catch John next week here on Trax FM from 7 p.m. UK time. Many thanks, John.
Cheers, mate. Thank you very much.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.